time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 18th of January 2014. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 18th of January, Sharon Brown talked to John Stansfield about the Waiheke Resource Trust and also his role as chair of the Waiheke High School Board of Trustees. She also spoke to fitness consultant Sarah Gloyer on Wharf to Wharf, Iron Man and Wild Woman.
Hi John.
Good morning to you, Representative Brown.
Great. Oh, you put me off now. Okay, well, here we are. So John, Waste Resource Trust. I love the video. There's a video that went up on Facebook. I don't know where else it's been. But was that organised by the Waste Resource Trust?
The rumours of the death of the Waste Resource Trust have been greatly overstated. In fact, we're still around and doing all kinds of interesting stuff. We've got two projects on at the moment. One of those is located in Blackpool, and it's a community development project. And essentially, we said to council, we believe that the community of Waiheke, if informed and empowered, could control its waste a lot better than the solution that you've got to town, which is to have a third wheelie bin to put your food waste and green waste in. And so the great daughter Ray has been working there with a team of volunteers and getting the community together and talking about waste and doing some dreaming and envisaging for their community. I went last night to the second of their pop-up pub events in Blackpool, and it was really well attended and it was great fun, and there's really good community building going on. And we've chosen Blackpool because we're able to use the census mesh block, and council did a pre-commencement baseline study. So we know exactly how much waste was coming out of there before we began work, and there's a whole project going on. We're going to try and get every household in Blackpool engaged in the food waste study, and also in being more connected to their part of the Blackpool community.
Mm. And so how far has that got? Are people starting to divert waste, or are they diverting it? Are they burying it in the garden?
All of the work that's been done on food waste so far has been what we call post-waste solutions. And Daughter and I did a study for the Ministry for the Environment back in 2010. And one of the things that came out of that study was we said you actually have to start working on pre-waste solutions. It's kind of a madness what's happened. They've brought in a third wheelie bin, and this is happening all over New Zealand, and that's to make what was once a vice now a virtue. And we say, well, good on you, Sharon Brown, for filling up your bin with food waste, whereas your grandmother would have been absolutely bloody horrified and probably spanked your bum and said, how dare you waste food? You know, this is very precious. And this is all the more important in the current context, because every bit of food you waste has a whole lot of embedded oil in it. Now, that's not to say that you're eating oil, but a lot of oil and a lot of carbon went into producing that food and distributing that food and putting it on a shelf before you came and bought it, and probably also wrapping it in plastic and a whole bunch of other things. So if you reduce wasting the food, you reduce the environmental impact and you improve the economy of the family. And people have got some fantastic strategies for how to do that. It's really good fun. And we've gone through a pilot phase, and we're just approaching rewriting the kits before we roll them out to every household.
Mm. So what are some of those strategies?
Well, the smartest woman I ever met was a woman called Diane in West Auckland on this. And she had a piece of high technology with her food waste. And that is, on her fridge door, she had on the end of a piece of string a whiteboard marker. And nothing went in or out of that fridge without being in a clear plastic container and having a date stamp on it. So she wrote the date on. So meal preparation began with opening the fridge and saying, well, what do I need to use up today? And then, what could I put with that to make it interesting? And she had great meals, and she had no food waste at all. Mm. Another thing that we found out with food waste is that The amount of food you waste is inversely proportional to the number of teenage boys you have. Essentially, teenage boys are the machines for devouring food waste. And one of the strategies I proposed, which I can't imagine why, but it was turned down, was that we should have flags on the letterbox like you used to have in the old days. So marauding packs of teenage boys would know that there was food in your fridge that needed cleaning up. Or perhaps we could have teenage boy feeding stations where we just dropped off the food at bus shelters and gangs of them could move around and kind of hoover it up. But on a more serious note, the thing that we found out from the study that we did and from the trial that we did back in 2011, I think, with some fantastic volunteers on Waiheke, was the thing you have to do to control food waste is to make it visible so that you think about it. So the high-tech thing that we use is a clear plastic bin which you put on your bench top, and all your food waste goes into there and has to sit there a couple of days before you can do anything with it. And just makes you very, very conscious, you know, because I mean, it's a nonsense that we have food waste, really. We have, you know, bigger refrigerators than anyone ever had in any generation before us. We've got click-clack, we've got cling film, you know, we've got crock pots for cooking down the bones, we've got microwave ovens for zapping the bugs, we've got all kinds of dried foods that, people didn't have before, and yet we're wasting food. What is with that?
That's an interesting way of putting it, yeah. Absolutely. And in terms of actually processing the food once it's been used?
Well, the idea of this project is to minimise what's actually going out in waste. The approach that's used in the past, and we've used it very successfully here in the past, we did a baseline study in 2001 and again in 2008. And during that period, the amount of food waste per household on Waiheke halved, and the amount of food waste per household in Auckland went up slightly. And that was really rolling out composting, doing the composting workshops, rolling out Bokashi, doing Bokashi workshops, doing little films around it, getting people kind of engaged and encouraging gardening.
So you don't think it was the people here taking their waste and giving it to their relatives in town to burn the bins?
Posting the old pork chop off to grandma. Well, it's possible, you know, but I think it's unlikely. But I mean, I just love it as a story because it's another one of those Waiheke does it better, you know. Yeah. We actually, if you give people the right information and the right tools, they'll generally make the right choices. Mm. And so you can govern either by using that as your principle and trusting people, or by doing kind of top-down solutions like a third wheelie bin and a set of regulations and fines. Mm. And that's how they seem to do it in other places.
So, I mean, partly I always think it's the fact that we've got things like, you know, quite an engaged media and, you know, local Facebook pages, so you can also promote things as well, and then people keep reinforcing it by, you know, because the circles of friends kind of overlap as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely,
it's just really interesting. Small communities, how much more engaged people are.
Oh, absolutely! Rock up at the market, and you can probably tick off 3,000 people in the heat of summer. Mm. You know, the local papers are actually read. And it's great, you know, it's really, really good.
Mm. So so in terms of this particular study, are you noticing that there is a drop in the amount of food that people are wasting?
At a self-reported level, we've got that so far, but we won't know that conclusively until we do the final waste survey at the end. But people are self-reporting, yes, actually. Mm. I didn't realise I was wasting food. In fact, I told you I wasn't, but when I started to put it in a bin on my bench, gosh, there was quite a lot of it. And, you know, one of the things that the most common thing by volume to waste is bread.
That's
fascinating to me, you know, because we've made bread so cheap. Bread's actually really cheap. That's one of the problems. I'm a trade baker, you know. New Zealand used to have little bakeries in every village that made the bread every day, and now it all gets made in these enormous big plants that do, you know, 50,000 loaves an hour, and the bread is made in 50 minutes where it used to be made in 23 and a half hours. The whole process is different. So we buy this kind of cheap, not that flash bread, actually, and then we go to the supermarket, and we can't remember whether we've got any in the cupboard at home, so we buy another loaf, and we come home, and, oh, shit, we already had some, and it goes mouldy, and we chuck it out. And we're just constantly throwing that stuff out.
But I find, yeah, I mean, I don't know, I'm so excited to have Franco's Bakery, because I do like to go and get lovely fresh bread.
Well, I think that's the solution, actually, is to buy less bread and buy better bread. You see, in my grandmother's day, you always had to have a loaf of bread in the house. That was kind of, they didn't have a whole lot of other substitute things, but we have wraps, we have crackers, we have Cruscuts, we have all of these other kind of bread substitutes that people didn't have, and they keep longer in the cupboard. So, yeah, don't buy as much bread. Go and buy a really good loaf of bread, eat it all, and then don't buy any bread for a couple of days until you're really hanging for it, and go and buy another loaf and enjoy it and love it and eat it.
Actually, I have a question for you. I mean, I find it's a sort of a life issue, in the sense that I don't have heaps of time to shop, and I don't want to be shopping all the time. So I try and, you know, shop once and get lots of stuff, and I don't always know exactly what it is that I'm using or I'm not using. And I find that's, even though I'm really conscious of waste and I don't want to waste, I end up generating waste, because I'm like, oh, I didn't get round to using those beans because I went out to dinner there, and I went out to the barbecue there, and there wasn't time to actually boil up the beans, and now guess what, they're all manky and gross.
That's right. So
that's the problem that I have, and I seem to generate it, and I know I could say, okay, well, don't buy it unless you know you're going to use it, but then at the same time I'll be there at home in another day and the kids are cranky and I don't really want to have to go out and shop to be able to feed them.
Yeah, well, it's all resource wastage problems, all of them, are the result of poor planning. And that's what it is. It's about planning. The really planned households don't have food waste.
Right, so I'm actually probably going to fail this one anyway. I'm expected to have another aspect of my life, which is planned.
That's right.
I find, you know, so some of your life you just have to kind of just, like, you know, enjoy it. It can't all be planned, otherwise you start to get a, like, massive headache.
We have such a lot of food that doesn't go manky. I mean, even if you know, beans, I think the best solution for beans is to grow them in the garden, and you're going to go and pick them when you want to eat them. That works pretty well. And if they get overdone, I just leave them in the sunroom until they dry, and then I have dried beans for the winter.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so there's the beans. Beans are solved.
Although I'm thinking, tick-tock, that's like another 2 hours I'm going to have to, like, scrabble about in the garden and then remember to water them. But, yeah, I mean, it's all part of life. Things that
if
you
you're
do.
Spending 2 hours in the garden, you must be growing flowers. I mean, maybe 30 minutes a week to feed the household.
Oh, really? Is that all you spend? Yeah. Oh, God, I need to spend more time around you then, obviously.
And we've got another project.
I'm really willing, but I keep forgetting at strategic moments that I need to water the garden.
That's right, yeah. Well, if you've got really good deep mulch, you won't have to water very often. But we have got another project I want to tell you about, which you alluded to. That is a project, Why Not Volunteer for the Environment? And Sharon from down the bottom end has been heading that up for us, and it's just about ready to launch. You've had a sneak peek at the first cut of the little film clip associated with that, and there's some other collateral going out, and there's a web presence where you're able to get in and see how to volunteer for various environmental groups and what you might get out of it.
Is that still to be launched?
That's to be launched very soon.
Lovely. So where did this, because I just happened to see it on a community Facebook page, but where is this video gone up? Oh, it hasn't. It's just a sneak preview. Okay, I'm not supposed to know. Nobody's supposed to know. Don't mention the video, anyone.
That's right. Don't mention the what.
Exactly. Okay, but tell us a little bit about that, because I know that I was interviewed by someone, was it Sharon? It might have been.
Yes, it was, yeah.
A few months ago, about my level of, you know, volunteering in community.
Sure.
And what I liked about it is she sort of had different things. She sort of had that thing of, you know, are you getting out to a forest and bird planting, or are you helping out at zero waste? But she also had things like, you know, do you spend a few hours doing doing some admin for an organisation, or, you know, did you do a submission on something that was environmentally related? And I think that's quite interesting because, you know, I tend to spend a lot of time, you know, on the computer sort of submitting on different things, and it always feels that that's never seen or... so it's quite nice that she was actually saying, oh, well, you actually do spend a bit of time doing different things.
So where the project originally came from was some thinking about us as a community, and the WRT is concerned with the environment.
Waste Resource Trust.
Waiheke Resource Trust. And we're concerned with the environment, but we're also concerned with sustainability at a broader level and with a joined-up community. And one of the things we thought about is, you know, we have quite a churn in this community. People come and they go a lot. And a lot of people come here because they kind of like some of those environmental values, but it's not always so easy to find out how you can get involved. It can be a little bit clicky. So we went both to organisations and individuals to try and get a map of how you get involved, what kinds of things you can do, what you might get out of being a volunteer, how you're going to meet a whole lot of other people in your community with similar values to you, and make a more connected community, as well as making those organisations more sustainable because they've got a pool of people coming in regularly to help. So that's what the project's about. We're very grateful to have sponsorship from the ASB Trust around that, and it's a piece of research that'll live on in the community, and that I hope that other organisations will join and use, and that new people coming to the island and people who are already here will use to find out how they can get involved.
Lovely. So you've got a... what I love about it is it's also making connections that might be useful for other aspects of people's lives. So in a sense, it's, you know, bringing people together who have an interest in environmental issues. Yeah. But potentially that could then spin off into finding connections for social enterprise, yep, or finding connections, yep, for starting a squash club, or, yep, yep, I don't, there might be, yeah, a squash club already, but, you know, yeah.
Yeah. And see, the thing is, we live in the most talented community. It's just extraordinary. And people seek us out as a result of that. I mean, as an organisation, we've been around for 16, 17 years. We've done all these great research projects. We had a fascinating thing happen over the summer. George Blanchard, who's one of our trustees and a former senior lecturer in mechanical engineering, and I were up at the engineering school looking at what projects we might collaborate with as a community in the school over summer. And we talked about, you know, energy and energy sufficiency, and a week later we got a phone call from a group of New Zealand Iranians who are involved in a revolutionary wind power project.
Those Iranians, you can't trust them, eh?
Oh, this is just such a cool story. So they've got this professor in Minnesota, and he's in, you know, the kind of engineering school, and he's looking at the air conditioning systems which were designed by the Iranians 2,000 years ago to keep their houses cool, which involve a clever way of ducting air across a small pool of water and speeding it up and having chilled air. And he says, look at this thing, going, well, this is just so cool because the air comes in at a speed of X, but by the time it comes out, it's coming out at four times the speed of X because of the way they've done the ducting. He goes, wow, that's really clever. Oh, wow, I wonder if we could use that for a wind turbine. And so they developed this wind turbine where instead of having great big blades sticking up in the air, there's kind of like this just beautifully sculptured little mushroom shape that sits up only 8 metres up and is dragging the air down. And all the whirligig and moving stuff and expensive equipment is down there on the ground in, wow, a little building. And it's easy to get at and maintain, and it's not subject to sort of, if a hurricane comes along, what happens? Well, the machinery doesn't get hurt. And it can generate terrific amounts of power. So we went walking around the school saying, right, so where would we put our power station for the island? And we visited three or four sites, and there's now some technical work going on backwards and forwards. And, you know, that's just another kind of aspect of the organisation.
Oh, interesting. What's interesting is that sort of old knowledge from different countries that you're bringing to
bear
and is informing, you know, modern technology. It's great.
No, this is really exciting.
These are things that, I mean, I'm always astounded. These are things that have taken thousands of years to develop and come up with and manage. And then somehow a lot of that knowledge is just being lost. So it's really great to see it all, you know, flowing through again. Oh, wonderful. Good. So segue into the school.
Yes. Well, exciting new year coming for us at the school. New principal starting on Monday. I hope she's made it.
Are you here? Hello, hello. What's her name?
Come in, Jude. Yeah, Jude's come to us from Marlborough Girls.
Oh, look, here she is. No, just joking.
And, and we're really excited about stuff that we're going to tackle as a board this year. It's, of course, knowledge now, I think, that it's very likely we're building an entire new school over the next 2 years. That's a somewhere between $13 and $15 million worth of expenditure, and we are in the planning stages of that with architects at the moment. The reason for the rebuild of the school is predominantly because of change in earthquake standards. I know that there's been some hysteria from the Fat Controller and others in Facebook and places recently about you know, health scares, but the primary reason is a change in earthquake codes, and happening all over the country. Is there any asbestos associated with the buildings? Well, of course they are. They're built of fibrolite, along with about 25% of the island. Fibrolite is made from, or was made from back in the day, asbestos and cement. I know that because my dad made it in a factory and I went as a kid and played in it. So it can't be as toxic as everyone had hoped.
But that explains it.
Yeah, it explains it, yeah. So, but the primary reason is about a change in earthquake standards.
Okay. And in any case, if it's in fibrolite, presumably it's stable?
Yeah, it's stable. And there will be, in any buildings, commercial buildings of that age, asbestos in some areas, typically in lagging of pipes and that kind of thing. But it's not, I mean, children aren't exposed to that, and it will have to be dealt with in a demolition process. But it's, you know, as it has been in every hospital in New Zealand, you know, and most commercial buildings of that age, it's nothing to get hysterical about.
No. Okay. And so, what are the key features? Where are we at with the rebuild or the plans? Or are there some, you know, interesting features that you can share at this stage?
Well, the big discussion that's going on is around what's called modern learning environments, and that's a move away from individual classrooms with an individual teacher with the door shut, locked up with 30 little kiddies sort of thing, to a much more open plan and collaborative space where several adults may be working with, you know, a larger group of students, where there'll be breakout areas, where work will be more inquiry-based and project-based than how it was when you and I went to school, Sharon.
So does it actually match up with, because I'm in education myself, and sometimes you can follow different fads and those aren't necessarily supported by other things that students need to do. So will that be supported by the exam or testing requirements or
Is there
movement there?
It's a fascinating response, isn't it? Because there's been some mischievous stuff in the community about, well, if you have a modern learning environment, you can't have NCEA because there'll be nowhere for the children to sit to do their quiz. And that it was actually said. At the high school prize giving, so I just about fell off my chair. I guess you're at AUT. The thing I would say to you is walk into the Paul Reeves building and ask me whether you'd like to be in there or in a traditional classroom. That's very much more a modern learning environment.
You see, I think to a degree, though, I think it also depends on, I mean, my experience of teaching is it also depends to a degree on students, and there are some situations in which and maybe it'll be served by a breakout area where, you know, the boundaries of a situation being clear physically are actually quite useful, and some people, you know, respond well to that security rather than a situation which is potentially a little bit drifty.
Yeah. Well, at some point in life, you have to learn to live with that kind of ambiguity. Mm. And I guess the question is, do we start teaching that to people earlier or do we hope that it'll happen magically when they hit the workforce at some point later? The whole nature of education is changing at an extraordinarily rapid rate. I'm also an educator. I'm the head of department out at Unitech. And, you know, we look at the safe place, which is the classroom, the way it always was, and say, well, not all students will do well in this new environment. Actually, you know what? Not all students do well in the environment we have now. And it's been interesting to look, for instance, at Albany Senior College, where people said, oh, this will be terrible for the kids who don't fit, the ones who have attention disorders and things like that. They have blossomed. They've done really, really well.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think, you know, the environment isn't everything. The thing that really matters in education is really good teaching.
Yes, and student-teacher ratios. And so that's the other thing that you need to be careful that further down the line, someone doesn't kind of go, oh, well, you know, you can manage so many more students in this space, and then we've got these computers, and so we can actually increase our ratios to one teacher to 45 students.
Yeah, I understand the argument, but I have to say the student-teacher ratio argument is not proven by research.
Mm.
Even Hattie says, no, we can't say that's absolutely the thing that matters. The thing that matters is having really, really good teachers.
Mm. At the same, I don't know, I feel that part of being a good teacher is knowing your students and being able to cater to their needs as individuals. And for that, any more than a class of 20, it actually becomes increasingly difficult to be aware of them. You're aware of the really strong ones. You're aware of the troublemakers. And then there's a whole sea in between that you're sort of like, yeah, they're functioning and they're fine and they're looking after themselves. Yeah. So I just think, you know, I'm just cautious, that's all.
Yeah, I think that's true in a particular model of pedagogy, but pedagogy shifts.
Mm. Yeah. And fair enough. I mean, it's all good, and I'm sure you'll
have we'll have really great fun. There'll be lots of opportunities to talk to the community about that. We are planning to have visits from staff at the school and some of the senior students over through some of the new environments that have been built. I'm going to, with the board, bring some people who have experience of those over here. You know, people have been very generous in other schools and saying, look, we did this and it was hell for 2 years, but now it is really, really fantastic and we're getting the best students and our role's gone up by 25% because kids want to come here. One Tree Hill College would be an example of that, formerly Penrose High.
Oh, great. So there are already examples.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so we're going to bring some of those people across and hold some hoos in the school hall and perhaps down at the Marae. And when we get closer to concepts, we will publish the plans and, you know, have a good, long, robust conversation with our community.
I think that's always the difficulty as well when you've got things like social media and a small community and what's going on. I'm noticing this with the board stuff. You can't always tell people things because you don't exactly know what it is that you're telling people. And then, you know, and then people are talking to each other and then there are all these, you know, odd rumours coming up. And yeah. So, great. Good luck with that. Can I just, a very quick question about the new principal? Can you tell us anything about her, or you know, why?
She's special. She's from Waikato. She's been at Marlborough Girls, but she's also taught in co-ed schools around the place. She's got a very strong academic record herself. Really believes very strongly in growing your own leaders and building staff capacity. And she has a strong suit in the arts and culture. She's a former classics teacher herself and has been known to break into song at the school assembly. Now, of course, so was our mayor, but, you know, where do we go with that? But I wouldn't like to draw that comparison. I think Jude's going to be great. The board's very excited about having her on board. She's very excited about coming here. And we're really looking forward to having a great year with her.
Lovely. Great. Well, thanks so much for coming in and telling us about the update and the Waiheke Resource Trust. It was renamed, wasn't it? Yes. And thanks so much.
Sure. And you can go and find out more about the Waiheke Resource Trust on www.wrt.org.nz.
Lovely. Great. Thank you.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
So, how are you?
I'm good.
Yeah, so here I am with Sarah Gloyer, who... is that how... Is that, is there something else that I need to add to that? No?
Nope.
No. Okay,
nope.
Great. And from Synergy Studios, and also a keen runner, and keen on promoting active lifestyles. And you've been following the Wharf to Wharf. Well, you were actually going to run in the Wharf to Wharf, weren't you?
Yes, I'm slightly injured at the moment, but nice to be a spectator for a change.
So is that the first time you've actually spectated rather than run in it?
Yes, it is, actually.
Oh, right. Yeah. So were you gnashing your teeth?
A little bit, except I was at the top of Calais Terrace and I was quite happy I wasn't going up there.
Ah, lovely. So so how's it going? How's it been going this
The Wharf to Wharf? Yeah. It looks good. I just came through 5 minutes ago along the last bit of the course, and there's still people out there walking. Lots of... I just talked to a couple of people I know who have three generations out there, nine members of their family.
Oh, wow.
Some of them had come from Oropew to Onitengi and then joined the younger crew and the older crew from Kennedy Point to Matietia. So doubling up a little bit, but quite neat. And a few people still coming through from Oropew, actually. So they've been out there for a while. It's always those people you've got to have a lot of admiration for.
Mm. Where do you usually run it from?
Well, actually, the first time I came to Waiheke was to do the Wharf to Wharf.
Oh, really?
Never been here before. And grabbed a boat in town and jumped off at Oropew. And I think that was 13 or maybe even 14 years ago. And really, it was what sort of made me fall in love with Waiheke.
Oh, interesting.
That, yeah.
I think it would have had the opposite effect for me. Sort of get off the boat and then have to run 13K. How far is it?
25. Well, I think it was actually 24 at that time because we finished at Mora Hall that year. And one of the best parts was they had these outdoor showers I'd never seen before.
Oh, okay.
There's lots of other good parts on the run, but that was a new one for me. That was sort of group showers as well. So,
oh, right.
Interesting.
Lots of fun.
Real Waiheke.
Okay, so that's how you got into the whole Waiheke scene.
Well, you know what?
Group showers at Mora Hall.
It was pretty stunning coming through that bottom end. Mm. And yeah, just really, really loved it. It's a pretty amazing thing to do. I sort of think we should have a Waiheke passport that you've got to do it at least once in your lifetime or you don't get the stamp.
Oh, right. Yes. Mm. Bit like the, you know, going to Mecca, something
yeah.
you have to do once
yep.
in your life. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So, but you've done lots of work on kind of thinking through, you're a runner yourself,
yep.
You know, active, and you've done quite a bit of work on opening up different tracks or thinking through different possible routes for runners.
Yeah. We actually have run a few events this year. And we have another one coming up, which will be the second time we do it, called the Wild Woman at the beginning of April. And I've got you tagged for taking part in that.
I
just
my
thought I'd
contact.
Let you know.
Eye contact dropping. Yeah. So tell us about it.
So Wild Woman is an 8K trail run. Starts and finishes at the Onitengi Sports Park. And it is a women's only run. Men are certainly welcome to run in it if they wear a pink tutu. And it's a real participation event. So certainly people can come and run it really fast. But it's mostly about getting women out there running on trails, maybe for their first time, maybe to get a better time than last year, maybe just have a good day out with some friends. Last year we had people dress up and we had ramen come and do a great warm up, and we had yoga and massage and
I know, it was
things
so
after.
Popular and it sounded amazing.
Yeah. So hopefully we built on that this year.
Is it a team event or is it an individual event?
We have teams and individuals and mother-daughter combos. And this year the mother-daughter will divide into mother-daughter sort of adult and mother-daughter child. And the idea is that they finish together.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, oh, I think my daughter would love to do that. I might actually do it.
Cool.
Yeah. So what's the mother-child option?
It's the whole... Everyone does the 8Ks, but people can walk or walk and run or run. So they enter, if they're going to run at all, they need to enter as a runner. But if they just want to walk, then they can enter as a walker.
Okay.
Combo they need to be.
And so the child has to be a certain age?
We have a limit of 6, actually. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, and I mean, the course is fairly close in. It goes through Whakanefa, but because it's only 8 kilometres, it's quite easy to manage. So if there's any issues, we'd be able to deal with
that. Well, that certainly appeals to me. The fact that it's a trail run as opposed to a road run really, really appeals to me. Because to be honest, I mean, I know that people do love running and they do the wharf to wharf, but I just cannot, that just doesn't sound pleasurable to me, running down a road.
That
stretches out infinitely in front of me. Whereas, you know, trails, you have the option of not, you know, that just seems more appealing to me.
They are almost two different sports in a way. A lot of runners will do both, but trail running is really increasing in popularity all around the world at the
moment. Why are they seen as being kind of significantly different?
There's obviously on a trail, there's a lot more technical work that has to go into it. So you've got to navigate your way through routes and narrow tracks, especially in Waiheke. And people who run trails really like that. It's also a softer surface. People who are strictly road runners get frustrated on trails because they can't have
power ahead.
It's cadence. They don't have as quick a turnover. And of course, you've got people that love to do both as well. Mm. And the wharf to wharf is a great event because, yes, it's on roads, but it's on Waiheke, and it's
lovely stuff to look at.
Yeah. And it's a lot different than running through city streets that are full of cars and all the rest of it. Mm. So yeah, the hills out the bottom end of on the wharf to wharf, the views from those hills make running on the road worth it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh no, great. Good. Yeah. Okay, well, I think you're persuading me, so I think I might actually have a go. I suppose I should get into training, and I do need something to work at. I'm terrible at just exercising for the hell
segment.
Of it, but I do find that if I have something to work towards, I'm more likely to kind of get in there and get stuck in, because I wouldn't want to come after the last person has given up and everyone's gone home.
We will be doing a 10-week program that people can follow from the 5th of February through to the day of that event. And there'll be a free online training that they can just follow. And then we'll also offer a package which involves coaching and some Pilates and things to keep your body healthy or balanced while you're doing that training. So lots of options.
I won't start too hard because honestly, I'm so unfit.
Yeah, well, just the main thing is just getting out there and developing a habit. You know, if you can say if every day for 30 days, you're going to do 20 to 30 minutes of movement, start getting out there and just doing it. That's the biggest thing for most people, is developing the habit more than and then you take
I know, and I did one of your boot camps and I was like, that's it, I'm in the habit. I tell you what, I came off the boot camp and since then it's just running for the ferry.
Your life's changed a little bit.
Well, that's
then
right.
As well,
I do
right?
find so. If I've got the children with me, it's really hard to
it's
just difficult to fit it in, but I'm hoping as they grow up, and my daughter loves running, so it's a great opportunity.
I think having a reason to do it is key for most people as well, you know, not just ticking a box like having to drink 8 glasses of water or eat 5 pieces of fruit and vegetables. You know, it's having a reason and end goal, then hopefully during that time it becomes something you don't want to give up.
Great. So how many entrants did you have last year for the Wild Woman?
Wild Woman last year actually was great. For the first time out, it was 140-something.
Mm-hmm.
We'd love to get 300 people this year.
Mm. And how in contrast, how many are there for the Wharf to Wharf? Do you happen to know?
Well, earlier in the week, I think they were up to about 600. So often, especially people on Waiheke, enter at the last minute. So they were hoping for 800, And just from what I saw out on the course today, between all four of the different distances, so there's Oropew to Maitiatia, there's Oropew to Onitangi, there's Onitangi to Maitiatia, and there's Kennedy Point to Maitiatia. So lots of different choices for people to do as far as how far they want to go. And between those, I would think they'd get up to 800 this year.
Wow,
yeah,
that's great.
That's pretty
so,
cool.
So 300 is a great number, especially as it's women. Do men take part? Do you get a few guys taking part?
We didn't last year. love to this year.
Is that a joke, or do they really have to wear something pink?
Be nice if they did.
Yeah.
They're totally welcome to.
Not that we're stereotypical. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure a blonde wig would be fine, or high heels.
Yeah.
High heels would be good.
Yeah, it would be very challenging. We're teaming up with hospice as well for the women's run this year. So part of the entry fee goes to hospice. And they've been great in just offering help with getting the word out there and things.
Oh,
so
lovely.
It just really strikes me as I went around today with the people. Some of them I've seen at the same water stops or checkpoints every year that I've been here.
It's quite a culture, isn't it?
It's pretty amazing.
Wharf to wharf water stop is quite a sort of...
Yeah, you know, the red hat ladies, they were down at Anzac Bay and just saw Jeff Honey. It's just around the corner from his house. He's done that as long as I've been here.
Really?
So yeah,
nice.
It's really pretty cool. And that, of course, is... Most of those people are, so Rotary has the event, and then most of those people at the water stops are involved in a community group, and they'll get a certain amount of money for the work that their group does on the day. So it's not only raising money for the community that Rotary puts back into it, but then they get paid.
That's tremendous,
for their
isn't it?
Club.
That's such a good model.
Yep.
It's such a great model for getting us all involved with things.
Yep.
Oh, terrific. So tell us again, Wild Woman, how do we register?
Right. Registrations will open up this week, and we'll put things up on Facebook and put something in the newspaper as well. There's registration online, but we'll also have printed entry forms. And... you just start looking for those, but there'll be lots of information out there.
Great. The cost?
The early entry will be $30 for adults, and I think it's $15 for children. There'll be a team entry. I can't remember exactly. Like, mother-daughter will be cheaper than the two individuals. And then the closer we get to it, it gets a little bit more expensive. So that's just to really encourage people to sign up early so we can get organized and they can start training.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Well, I am inspired.
Cool.
And now I just have to find the time. But I think, you sign up and then you find the time and then it all works out.
Yeah, commit to it and then just do it.
I think
it.
There are some board meetings coming up. I think that would be a good training opportunity.
Yeah, actually.
Just be like, sorry, I can't come to the board meeting because I'm just doing some training on a Thursday evening. So that would be fine to plan it for a Thursday night.
Friendly competition, because I believe Beetle's going to be doing it as well.
Oh, is
yes.
she? Oh,
yes.
Lovely.
So yeah, you guys could... You guys could
team up.
Yeah,
maybe her daughter might come back. We could be around.
True.
Do combined mother daughter teams.
Yes, I think this year as well. Last year, if you were entered mother daughter, you couldn't win in the individual category. But this year, because what happened last year was actually the mother daughter team that won. They also were second and third overall.
Oh, well,
so it was
a
little
really
bit, yeah,
team.
Yeah. So we're just going to have a look at that, because it's nice to reward people for what they do, you know.
Yeah. Oh, nice. And I think I don't think you had. Did you have a separate mother daughter child team last year? Because I thought
no.
My daughter was a bit young or something.
No, we didn't. And so the mother daughter team that won last year were both adults.
Mm.
One was in her 20s, and she was super fast. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 Ah,
just while we're on the subject of running as well, the Harriers, I don't know if you know much about them on the island.
Just the name, and I know that some people are quite keen. Tell us more.
Yeah. Well, there is a group of really fast Harriers, but as that group's been growing over the last couple of years, and really that's been Gary Wilton behind that in a really big way. He's club captain, and he's really gotten out there and chase people up to get out running. But yes, there's a really fast group, but as the group has grown, there's a really big spectrum that is covered. And as the group gets bigger, it's easier to actually divide off into different paces. So the more, the merrier. And if people are just starting out, it's good to be able to run at a steady pace for about half an hour before you join in that group. But
is that the fast group?
Just in any of the runs. So there's 5 runs a week with the Harriers as well. And that's really fantastic because you get the support from the group as well as just a friend or a coach or a trainer.
So in your ideal world, you would get people to go into Wild Woman, train for that, which kind of shows that they could probably run for about 30 minutes, and then join the Harriers. So it's going to be like people crossing the finish line and you're going to be handing them paper and sign here.
Well, you know what? Last year we had people that had never run before do the Wild Woman, and some of them were out there today doing the 25K. So,
were they?
Yeah.
Well, that's a huge achievement, isn't it?
And, you know, they went on to do Auckland Half Marathon and some other events as well off the island, and just really, for some of them, it's become a lifestyle. That's success.
So that's fabulous. Right, so just one last question. There's development at the Onitangi Sports Park that was kind of led by, I think, Gary Wilton as well. And I think you took part in that as well. What was your experience of that, or how did that go?
Great. It was a really good meeting. The original meeting with all of the different groups that used
So this was a sort of a consultation with all the different stakeholders who...
Yeah. At that time, it was sort of like, hey, we've got some money in the budget to do something to specifically the building, right? And, you know, on Waiheke, we're all pretty passionate and but we can be a bit fiery at times. And often I find with recreation things, people are looking for something, maybe looking at how do we get our little patch of something. And it was the first time I'd witnessed everyone sort of going, how do we make this work better for everyone, which was really so exciting. And I just hope we can carry that on with discussion and looking at the bigger picture and not knee-jerk reactions to what do I need to run and protect now for me or for my group, but how is everyone... Because it's, you know, on the island, people that play soccer often play tennis, and people that play frisbee golf are runners, and so it's all about what's great for everyone.
And everyone goes and buys stuff at the supermarket and potentially meets you know, a golf player behind the checkout.
And I think there's just massive potential for what can happen, not just at the sport. We're so lucky. I mean, I never feel like we're hard done by with what we've got, but there could be a lot more with. And people, I think they need to talk and look at the big picture.
Oh, absolutely. But it's been tremendously exciting because Gary actually came to the board and showed the different things that had been discussed.
Yeah.
And it was just really interesting to see how all these different groups had thought, well, you know, we can, this would be a really exciting project. And other people are going, yeah, that would be really cool.
You know, what was cool when we left that first meeting, and so the stuff that came out of that first meeting was the stuff you're talking about, and everyone was going, hey, what should we even be going away and doing our individual thing, or should we actually be doing this together? Which was like kind of earth-shattering for Waiheke. So that was good. That was a really good thing. And I think out of all of that and all of this, good stuff will come.
So the main things, just to sort of just flag it, I think we're going to be talking about it at the board meeting that's coming up, but it's there seem to the thing, the higher priority things seem to be an extension for the soccer.
Yeah, at the moment soccer sort of got a tractor shed that has roller doors that when they open them they can't see the field. So I think that, you know, having a space that they can have the kids go inside when the adult games are on, or be able to see their field.
Space.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
host the teams that come.
And then there were some picnic tables, I think, to make it all a bit more jolly for visitors, for people who are supporting the games, but also just people who are, you know, potentially if the Wild Woman is functioning and there's a race going through, or the mountain bikers want picnic tables, that was another thing. And, I mean, personally, I'd quite like to see a change to the... changing rooms. Well, actually, that's another thing. What do you make of the changing rooms in terms of women's use of them?
Do you mean just on any given day or when there's sports on down there?
Yes. Well,
The thing with the changing rooms, if you've got soccer and rugby on, there's only 2 changing rooms. And so you'll have four or more teams between two changing rooms, which, especially if there's a women's team there, that can be a bit of a problem.
So how do they manage that?
Delicately.
Right.
Yeah, and so what happens now is they'll sometimes have to take everything out of the change room and store it somewhere else so that it's everything safe for the other team, and stagger the starts of things and make sure that... what would be ideal is if there was actually four. And then you've got the kids' teams down there as well sometimes at the same time or earlier in the day.
Mm. It's great that rugby and soccer have so many teams coming over and using it.
Really growing. You know, and soccer's grown in a big way in the last few years, thanks to volunteers, of course, at the club. So
tremendous. Great. Okay, so register for Wild Woman. Oh, there's the Ironman competition tomorrow as well in town, which is a major international event.
Yep.
Are you going down for that?
I probably will go over, and it's a fantastic spectator setup down there for the Ironman, right down at the viaduct. Just jump on the boat and you're there. There's bleachers and things, but just going along the road where the course comes in is fantastic.
And you can see where the swimming is, because that's just over on the other side of Prince's Wharf.
Yep. You probably need to get there a little bit early to get a good view of the swimming, but and that's over and done fairly quickly in the morning. But the run last time, and I would imagine they've done it the same, it's on a circuit, so they come through, I think, four times.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
If you're standing on Custer Street somewhere.
Yeah, so it's not one big loop. They're looping through.
Oh, great.
So it's quite exciting, and same with the bike. I think this year the bike might be an out and back, but you're still seeing a lot of action.
Mm. So definitely get down, probably on the 8 o'clock boat then, to check it out and watch it as a spectator.
Yeah. Great for kids to go over and see that. You know, that's some pretty incredible athletic ability from all over the world.
Oh, brilliant. But having said that, if you're not going over for that, you might actually want to avoid Central Auckland. Have you? Because you've also had experience of trying to cross Central Auckland when it's been on.
Well, yeah, they just sort of, because Key Street is part of the course, and so they send you underneath the street. And I had a dog with me, of course. So it was all fine, but it was a little bit of a, it took a little bit longer, just allow a bit more time. And as long as you know what's going on and you're prepared, I think that's
all right. How did you go under Key Street?
I don't know. They just shuttled us down. It was near the train station, and we went under a building and then through sort of a hotel lobby. We were on the other side of the road. Yeah.
Right. So it was to get across Custom Street.
Maybe.
Right.
Maybe.
Okay.
So
anyway,
it was different.
Sounds like a war tunnel, right?
Yeah, it was cool, actually. It was quite good to know it's there.
Great, lovely. Well, that's the end of Island Life. Thanks so much for coming on the show. And, good luck with setting up the Wild Woman stuff. And hopefully we'll get 300 people there this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you. Oh, and just a website, how will we know on the website, or is there a Facebook page?
There's a Facebook page, Synergy Sport, if you search that.
Okay.
It'll pop
have
up.
All the information. Great,
yeah.
Thanks so much.
Awesome.
Great.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, a weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.